The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, a little more about the normal striatum. Then we'll spend the rest of the time talking about Parkinson's disease and treatment of Parkinson's and with methods that are being explored not just for Parkinson's but other diseases as well. We ended on this rather difficult network diagram. The one thing that I note that's missing here, besides the obvious things like I didn't put in the neocortical connections except the one from the thalamus because it receives a striata connection. And actually, the major output of the globus pallidus is to the ventral thalamus. Where does the VA of the thalamus project? Does anybody know? You know what the ventral posterior nucleus is? It gets the spinothalamic tract and the dorsal, the medial and meniscus pathway carrying some sensory information. But that's the caudal part of the ventral nucleus. The more anterior parts of the ventral nucleus are related to motor areas of the cortex. So the VL projects to the primary motor cortex, that's in the middle, and the VA projects to the premotor cortex. Okay, both can be considered motor cortex. The VA differs from the VL in that it's more concerned with movement patterns than, whereas the motor cortex itself, when stimulated, moves individual muscle groups controlling a single finger, for example, or wrist or elbow or a single joint. But what's missing from this that I wish I had more on was inputs to the subthalamic nucleus, especially because that nucleus is providing the major excitatory projections to the globus pallidus and to the nigra. Obviously, very important. If you're missing that, the whole system becomes unbalanced and you get some pretty striking movement pathologies in humans. The only thing I could find was there are projections coming in there, excitatory projections from somatosensory cortical areas and some more directly from somatosensory pathways coming from below. So what exactly that means, you know, what I would like to see is a good computer model of this entire system, because that's obviously pretty complex, and I think it would help us a lot in understanding how this whole system works. But anyway, the kind of connections we have here within inhibitory pathways that are then connected to structures that inhibit further structures. So you have inhibition of inhibitory pathways. Obviously important in understanding the kind of things that go wrong in basal ganglia disorders. Parkinson's disease is the first example here. That's where you get cell loss here in the substantia nigra. And the cells that are being lost are in the pars compacta here that provides the dopamine input, putamen and caudate, and leads to, that's one of the major things that happens in Parkinson's. And the striatum doesn't work well. You get, the most obvious thing is you get a tremor of rest. And if they make an intentional movement, they'll stop the tremor. If they're just sitting still, they'll show this kind of tremor. Very characteristic of Parkinson's disease. But as the disease progresses, you get an akinesia. They move less and less. They have a characteristic gait. It's very recognizable. And then in the late stages of the disease, there are other things that happen too. Cognitive deficiencies show up. Other systems are clearly affected, not just the dopamine pathways in the nigra. But it is that nigral degeneration that accounts for the things that we see in when Parkinson's disease is diagnosed. Then other diseases like you get cell loss in the striatum and Huntington's disease, which is a genetic disease. Where it doesn't appear until adulthood, when people initially it looks like whenever they intend to move a limb, they instead of moving the limb in a controlled way, they make a ballistic type movement. Have any of you ever seen people with these things? Parkinson's disease in aged people is more common. Whether that's really Parkinson's disease, they have Parkinson's-like symptoms because they begin losing cells due to vascular insufficiencies. But anyway, in chorea, or especially in hemivalvism, they have a lesion of the subthalamic nucleus on one side. And when they intend to make a movement, they make a ballistic movement, that is a flinging movement. The claim is that even these become involuntary. To what extent that's really true, I'm not sure. But people say they didn't intend to doing that, but on the other hand, we're constantly making small movements. And basically, their habits now cause them problems because they don't have normal control. Huntington's chorea, the genetic disease, they make writhing movements. It was named a chorea or dance-like movement, but basically they're involuntary movements. When people first getting it, they tend to hide it, you know, as if pretend they were doing something intentionally, but in fact it gets worse and worse until it becomes very obvious that they don't have any control. So we think the double inhibition helps explain it, because when you lose a lot of inhibition, cells can become hyperactive and produce abnormally increased movement instead of lack of movement. And in Parkinson's disease, you get reduced movement except for the tremor. But in these others, you get excessive movement. So, let's go back to a more inclusive view of the striatum, talk about integrate the limbic striatum with this. We went through that a little bit in the last part. The limbic structures are here in the hemisphere, and we're talking now in the limbic striatum, the structures of the striatum that get the output of these limbic system structures shown in the red stripes. And you know our concern with motivation and emotion. And this is the view we want. If you look at the striatum in the hemisphere, if the hemisphere is transparent, you would see the striatum in these locations, and the entire ventral striatum. I would include the amygdala as part of it. We know that the amygdala is actually a combination of pallial and striatal structures, but a good part of it is striatal, and it functions in many ways like a striatal. Like the dorsal striatum does with its connections from neocortex, the ventral striatum and amygdala do for the limbic system, including the formation of learned habits. But the habits, of course, are very different for ventral striatum. They're habits of feeling and emotion. I don't think I'm going to go through this in detail because it's Larry Swanson's more inclusive view of the striatum. I will simply summarize it this way. He, of course, has first the dorsal striatum and pallidum, somatic system, caudate putamen with its outputs to the pallidum, which are the globus pallidus, two segments. I just want to point out, if any of you deal with rodents and you try to find that internal segment, it's very difficult because it basically cells embedded in the peduncle. It's called the entopeduncular nucleus, the nucleus enclosed by the peduncle. But it is there, nevertheless, these cells with the connections. But in the larger animals, the pallidum is quite separable. But all these other structures you could call part of the ventral striatum. But he includes the septal nuclei, and he calls it medial striatum and pallidum, and amygdala structures. And he has the palatal part as the bed nucleus, the stria terminalis. It's the way some people really like to systematize this, and Swanson's like to do that. But I just take all of these structures and call it the ventral striatum, okay? Because there are a lot of similarities in the way these structures function. Okay, they're all getting outputs. They're all getting outputs from the limbic cortical regions. They're all involved in habit formation. Pretty much parallel to the way the dorsal striatum works for the non-olfactory and non-limbic systems. All right. Can anyone answer question 8 for me? Just contrast the neocortical projections to the putamen versus the projections to the caudate. How are they different? Why is it when we treat Parkinson's we're always dealing with the putamen, when actually the caudate is also involved? Sorry? It's because exactly the inputs to the putamen are from the sensory motor areas of the neocortex. Somatosensory and motor areas. Areas 3, 1, and 2, area 4, area 6, in Brodmann's terms. Why, in question 9, I'm trying to say here, why would you expect the corpus striatum to be involved in almost all of the functions of neocortex? The answer is very simple. Almost all of the neocortex projects to the striatum. You could say a similar thing for the cerebellum. Okay, all of those structures that get cerebellar input, you know, input from neocortex, so many neocortical areas project to the pons, which then projects to the cerebellum. So we know that the cerebellum then has got to be involved in more than just simple coordination of movement. As a result, coordination of a lot of things involved with timing adjustments that the cerebellum is so good at. In this case, it's the striatum. That means when you have corpus striatum pathologies, you can get many different problems besides. But the thing that people notice the most, it's the most common complaint of people with damage to the corpus striatum, or, of course, any of these diseases, is the effects on movement. This is just a picture that shows the central cortex here. And by central cortex, we always mean somatosensory, motor, and premotor or supplementary motor area. There's a number of premotor areas. The supplementary motor area is one of them. Okay. And it shows the projections from there in this reddish brown going to the putamen, lateral to the cerebral peduncle. This is where the lateral to the internal capsule, I should say. And the internal capsule fits in here. The caudate nucleus is mostly medial to it. The anteriormost part is the largest, called at the head of the caudate. It's getting inputs from all of the other cortical areas, including some of these areas he's left. This is from a picture in Brodo. He leaves some of these white, including the visual areas here, but in fact, even in the hamster that I've studied, I trace projections here from the visual areas. I see the projections of the caudate nucleus. And it also includes prefrontal areas here. All right, and this is an updated view of the projections from cortex. And I just show one section of the cortex here, how it projects to the entire striatum, both dorsal and ventral, and also to the intralaminar and midline nuclei. Because these nuclei, remember, have direct projections to the striatum. So that means this little area here, the paraventricular nucleus, one of the midline nuclei, it projects to this corner of the striatal structures, including where the nucleus basalis is. And this area of the cortex projects to that same area. So you'll see it's a highly organized system. The parts most similar to dorsal, what we've been calling dorsal striatum, involved in getting the input from somatosensory and motor cortex, they show in green here. You can see here that that's going to the dorsolateral region of the striatum. So the ventral striatum is really ventromedial here. Dorsolateral and ventromedial, according to more recent studies of these projections. And the input to the caudate is much more complex. I went through some of the studies and found this kind of system where you got projections from orbital frontal cortex that form these huge columns medially, and they could be traced in that same position all around to the very tail of the caudate. This is internal capsule in here. Okay. And here are other parts of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, posterior parietal, which is very far from the prefrontal. You see, it's all these different areas here and here are projecting this complex pattern to the caudate. But it's actually more complex than that, because if you look at the actual studies, like here, they trace projections here from prefrontal areas and here from parietal cortex. And then you look at a part of the striatum, you see these, it's not entirely blue here and pink here, but in the middle here there's a lot of interdigitation, indicating that there's a lot we don't understand about how this is working. That is, the striatum itself must be doing some integration of these inputs, because this interdigitation of the projections of the anterior and posterior association areas, this area and this area, those two projections tend to be very close to each other in the striatum. Why is that? To do that, we have to understand a lot more about that cortex, which we haven't talked so much about yet. But in fact, this pattern is not well understood. Its functions are not well understood. Okay. this slide talks about in clinical neurology. They talk about these different functional circuits involving the striatum. All of that's to be expected when you know that all of these different cortical areas project there. For example, frontal eye fields, frontal lobe, we know are critical for intentional eye movements, can be affected by striatal lesions. Well, that area projects to the striatum. Just like the motor cortex and somatosensory cortex do. Other parts of the prefrontal cortex project there, and because of that, other cognitive functions that are so important in human functioning that depend on prefrontal cortex, you'd expect them to be damaged. It's just not as common in these basal ganglia diseases. Maybe it's because we don't know. A lot of people go through life without actually exercising higher cognitive functions that well. I say that with tongue in cheek, but I think it's probably right. So we don't notice it when they suffer a pathology. We just think he had too much to drink a little bit too often, or he's getting old, or this or that. Whereas in fact it could be due to striatal functions. And similarly, the limbic areas that affect mood and emotion, because they project to the striatal areas as well, striatal damage or any pathologies of the striatum, that's a common area for interruption of the vascular supply to the forebrain, vessels that come in from the base of the brain, go up through that ventral striatum, and sometimes they reach the internal capsule as well. So you'll get not just the movement disorders from the interruption of those axons of the internal capsule, you'll get changes in mood and emotion as well. Okay. Another complication that I mentioned in the chapter is the striatosomes. This is an interesting compartmentalization. It's a little different from that interdigitation of the projections from the anterior and posterior association areas of cortex. This refers to the projections of acetylcholine axons and the staining for cholinesterase that you get in the striatum. There are areas in the striatum where there's almost no staining for cholinesterase, and other areas where there's heavy staining. So we call them striatosomes, where there's no staining. We know they have to be functionally different. It's been very difficult to work out the functional differences. I mentioned some of the recent work in that area in the book. I think we talked about the length of... these are about the cell types. There's huge numbers, but most of them are characterized. These are just structural divisions where you have these large interneurons of the striatum. This is throughout the striatum you get these cell types, acetylcholine-containing cells. They're short axon interneurons using acetylcholine. So we know that that's why there's cholinesterase staining. And yet, now we know there's these areas that don't get it. We just don't know completely why that's true. And there's many cells that use GABA. There has to be, because of all these inhibitory projections. We know that the dorsal striatum projects directly to the nigra with a GABAergic pathway. It projects to the lobus pallidus, both segments with GABAergic pathways. But those GABA cells, the GABAergic cells, can be further characterized in terms of peptides they contain. Like one type contains not only GABA but substance P, and it tends to project to the nigra and to the internal segment of the globus pallidus. GABA with enkephalon, those cells project to the outer segment of the globus pallidus. So they're using the same main neurotransmitter, but they're modulated by different peptides. Again, not fully understood, but clearly they have some functional difference. This is where I mentioned the striatomes and those acetylcholine interneurons. I just want to say a little bit about these terms used for humans, the lentiform nucleus. Did I talk about that before? This shape right here is the lentiform nucleus, the lens-shaped nucleus. The outer part is putamen, and the inner parts are the two segments of the lotus pallidus, the output structures. That's the lentiform nucleus. There's the internal capsule, and medial to it, there's the caudate nucleus. It looks small here, but you know, this is a big human brain, so it's actually not so small. So you see the same thing on the two sides. I think we saw this before when we talked about the output, the ansa, the lenticularis, the pathway that goes from the globus pallidus here, that loops around the internal capsule and goes to the anterior. Ventral anterior thalamus. Okay, so you can see if you were doing a dissection how you would get to it and go into the Sylvian fissure here. Here it is in the photograph. You can just push it apart and you expose this buried cortex. What is the buried cortex called? Called the island, the insula, the island cortex. Sort of a, I guess it looked like that to anatomists going in through the fissure and finding that cortex down there. It's covering the outer part of the striatum here, the putamen. There's another little layer of cells there between the putamen and the neocortex called the claustrum. Okay, which gets very widespread inputs, and I'm not spending time on that in the class now. But we talked about temporalization and how that forms. I just wanted to point out that in this picture, these are the axons that form the internal capsule coming down through the striatum. So if this is left hemisphere, the caudate nucleus is on the other side of it. Okay, it would go all the way around. But back here, what does it do? Well, the caudate goes all the way around. So down here, you see it below those axons. So if you make a cross section, you can see the caudate there and there. There's white matter in between the caudate and the other parts of the putamen. And here we see white matter here, between caudate and putamen, or the whole length of the nucleus, in fact. And remember that if we follow the caudate all the way around, right here, it abuts the amygdala. So this would be the position of the amygdala here. So let's talk about Parkinson's disease now. I'm sorry I didn't deal with, I left a lot of things hanging there, but it represents the way the field is, to tell you the truth. You know, there's a lot we don't know. So, I want to talk about one of the major treatments that was developed in recent years. It's interesting because it was based on neuroscientific study. It began with studies of rats. And then move to a new treatment for Parkinson's disease using tissue transplantation from fetal humans, a product of abortions that are obtained in abortions, tissue that would normally be thrown out, but they were legally able to get that tissue and use them. You will see about how old they had to be, but they were always from tissue that would have simply died if it wasn't used. But then we'll talk about new neurons for the adult brain, not just implanted neurons, but neurons that are either from stem cells or normally generated in the brain of adult animals, and mammals, including humans. We've talked about that once before when we talked about the olfactory bulb. I talked about new neurons being generated in the lateral ventricles, even in adulthood, and how they migrate forward and they're into the granule layer of the olfactory bulb where there's cell turnover. Constantly those cells in the olfactory bulb are being replaced. The same thing happens in hippocampus, so we'll talk about that. So let's talk first about the fetal Nigral transplantation as a therapy for Parkinson's disease. My brain imaging is used to assess the success of those transplants before any functional effects are seen. They can find out if the cells are surviving. And then we'll talk about the new cells. Does everybody understand what Parkinson's disease is? Why is it that we know the cells of the nigra that produce dopamine are gradually lost in Parkinson's disease? Why is it they don't see any symptoms of Parkinson's disease until 80% of those cells are gone? Any suggestions? Do you remember what I said in the book? Why don't you see symptoms until 80% of them are gone? You know, in fact, as we will see, the treatments for it would be more successful if they could catch it earlier, but they don't. The reason seems to be collateral sprouting. When you remove a small proportion of the dopamine-containing cells, the axons die, going to the striatum, dopamine axons, but the remaining ones simply sprout collaterals, take over the space. There's a lot of evidence for that, because it happens in many systems, not just in baby animals, but in adult animals. You get collateral sprouting into the denervated areas. So, for example, if I cut, remember I gave this example a long time ago, chapter 13, you lose axons in your hand due to an arm injury, or maybe pressure too long on your arm, transects some axons. Okay, they will regrow, but before they regrow, you can lose function. You can lose your ability to extend your hand, for example. I mentioned that happened to me once. And then, what happens? You don't have to wait for the regeneration to occur before you get return of function. Why is that? Collateral sprouting, because you haven't killed all the axons. The remaining ones will sprout over a period of about 2 weeks. That will happen, and you start getting most of your function back. You have to have adequate innervation, or you feel extremely weak. You have to have a lot of innervation to get those muscles to discharge properly. Okay, but the same thing is happening in the corpus striatum. Collateral sprouting. And because it's ongoing, it's probably the reason why making lesions gradually in a slow-growing tumor is also a lot harder to detect, because you're getting connections being replaced. It's when you make the lesion all at once that you see the maximum effects of the lesion. Anyway, the most dramatic discovery of a treatment concerns this use of tissue from fetal nigra. And this is what I mainly want to talk about here, fetal nigra transplantation. They're basically taking nigral tissue just removed from a fetus. It's little chunks of tissue put in a solution. They suck them into a pipette and inject them. It's basically what they're doing. Why do you think it might be true that the topographic organization of connections isn't a critical factor in the functioning of the nigrostriatal connections? You're not causing a regeneration of nigra to striatum. You're just putting the nigral tissue directly into the striatum. Normally the striatum doesn't contain dopamine cells. But if they put the dopamine cells into the midbrain, what do you think the axons are ever going to reach the striatum? It's a big distance in adult humans. It wouldn't work, yes. Right, that's part of the research that was done. No, but they were interested in working out the best ages of the human tissue because, you know, you don't want to go doing that procedure on humans when the fetal tissue is not in plentiful supply, especially because then putamen, they're putting it all in the putamen because they're trying to treat these bad motor symptoms, you see. So they're not focused on the caudate nucleus, they're focused on the putamen. And the putamen is very large in adult human, and those fetuses are very tiny. So the problem is you put it in the putamen. The axons from those new cells that they're putting in there don't grow very far. They grow very slowly and they don't grow very far. We'll review that quickly here. So you need a number of fetuses to get a really adequate implant for one patient. And that means it's hard to get enough fetuses. Because there's a lot of people with Parkinson's. Yeah, even if they could do that, and I don't know of any research that really tried that, but when in other systems they have tried and generally it fails. Because once systems contain a lot of myelin, the myelin inhibits the growth of axons because of the no-go protein. Very difficult to get the growth. If our knowledge of how to get it to happen, we're a little more advanced, we could create pathways where it would go. You see, the problem is you're putting the dopamine cells directly into the putamen. That means the normal circuitry, the normal stimulus for those nigral cells is missing. Okay? But what they were counting on is, and from this worked on in rat research, they got a lot of function back just in spite of all that. Okay. So anyway, we don't think the topography is very important because we're just dealing with as I point out here, the action of dopamine release doesn't require high information content. It's a neuromodulator. It's simply changing the way those cells are working in the putamen. So that's why we think it really doesn't matter, the topography. Yeah, well, that's another issue, isn't it? The striosomes versus non-striosomes could drastically affect how it's working. At least subtle aspects of movement and the way people learn habits and so forth. Maybe they can't learn much. You know, you'd like to look to see how much do they really study these patients that do get some recovery. But the question you're asking is a major one. You need to find those things out. We know that the donor age is critical, and why would we expect that? Well, studies of the development, the ontogeny of human dopamine-producing cells, indicate that they first appear 5.5 to 6.5 weeks post-conception. And little processes grow out from those cells beginning at 8 weeks post-conception, And the axons first reach the striatum at 9 weeks. Well, once they've already grown all the way to the striatum, we already know from various studies of animals that when you damage cells that have already grown a lot of processes, they become much more vulnerable. So they're going to die if you damage them very much, because then you're damaging a lot of the processes. Okay, so it was predicted that you would have to go in this early period before most of those processes, the dendrites and axons, have even grown. Okay, and that's what they found. And to do that research, as you mentioned, they're actually taking the human tissue and putting it in a rat striatum when they found out that they could do that successfully. So they wanted to find out which ages to use. So you see a lot of surviving cells. The black indicates the dopamine. Actually, it's tyrosine hydroxylase, the enzyme that you always find in the dopamine processes in cells. They took it from a fetus 41 days post-conception that survived very well in the rat striatum. If they took it from a 72-day post-conception, that's after the axons have normally already started reaching the striatum, then they didn't get good survival. So they knew they had that's how they found out the age range they had to use. Okay. Now, how can they use imaging of the living brain to assess transplant success? By using fluorodopa, which allows you to use positron emission tomography and find evidence for living dopamine cells. And of course, if the patient dies, they can use neuroanatomical methods, basically immunostaining for tyrosine hydroxylase. And they can assess them post-mortem. Okay, you can read about fluorodopa online and how it's used. And this just mentions the histological procedure on the autopsy material to find out where those dopamine cells are. And this is just some of the results. The dark staining here is dopamine. You don't get tyrosine hydroxylase unless it's in live cells. And you see, if you look in higher magnification, there's a whole felt work of processes. Dopamine has... this is all from a graft, because when they do these... this is from a human brain with surviving graft, fetal tissue. There's a lot of dopamine axons in parts of the putamen. If they get a long ways from where they put the implants in, this is what it looks like. Almost nothing in the right, because they don't grow very far. Okay? Here's where they're putting in rat, and you see very good survival here. And here you see them surviving, how they use that to predict when they would be successful in humans. So, and I mentioned this, it makes a big difference on where you put it because the size of the human striatum is so big. This is about the rate of growth. I use 6 here to calculate that they would grow about a millimeter in 7 days at 6 microns an hour. We know that they never seem to grow more than about 2.5 millimeters. Remember, this is adult tissue, and there's a lot of inhibitory factors. It's surprising to some people that they grow even that far. Okay, so we know the locus is important because the functions of the striatum differ from different parts, and they're interested in the motor symptoms, so they put it in the putamen. Okay. So why do you think it's so slow? It takes many months, even longer than the axons have grown out, according to the fluorodopa results. So we know that there's probably other aspects of maturation of the neurons that require a lot of time. So it took a lot of patience doing this. and I mention other issues that are involved. The lack of normal inputs, the fact that Parkinson's disease involves other cell groups than just the dopamine cells. It involves norepinephrine cells, for example. We know less about the function of those groups in the striatum than I mentioned the collateral sprouting in addition. And but we don't, the point is if the dopamine axons are showing collateral sprouting, well, what about other axons? When there's denervation, other axons can show collateral sprouting too. So then the dopamine axons have to compete with those. And the competition can take a very long time. And it might not always be successful. It's not easy to predict which axons will actually win out. Usually the normal axons will win out. But now they're not from the same person. They came from elsewhere. Does that mean they can compete just as well as the person's own dopamine cells would? We don't know. So I'm asking about alternatives that treatment. I think I won't take time to go through this. You can read about it. The stem cells are the most interesting. The scientific studies indicate that for advanced Parkinson's patients, there doesn't appear to be much use of using this procedure. It just doesn't work. It worked well, though, for people that are less severe. That is, the Parkinson's hasn't progressed as far. So for them, it did work. But of course, they're really concerned with those people with the more advanced symptoms. And they decided that the transplant procedure just wasn't good enough, so that led to other types of treatments. The thing used in the clinic, there's two methods used in the clinic. One is called deep brain stimulation. If you go online and just type in deep brain stimulation, you'll find all kinds of articles. Because medical residents and hospitals love to do research and get their names on papers, so you'll find paper after paper after paper on their use of deep brain stimulation. And yes, it works very well. You stimulate the bulbous pallidus, you stimulate the subthalamic nucleus, you can get effects. Okay, often you can benefit the patients. Because remember, they're missing a lot of the normal input from those pathways that affect the system. So if you stimulate it artificially, you can improve their symptoms. And so that's what they find. They also have gone in and just ablated structures. And if they do that right, the problem here is predicting. Well, how do you know? You only get one chance. Ablated, you're not going to get a second chance. But they have found specific lesions that they base it on animal work first, and they do get some benefits, reducing the movement problems. And I just mentioned examples of lesion. I'll talk a little more about the neurogenesis things, but make sure you read that, and I'll answer any questions you have about it. But there's a few very interesting issues here about using using stem cells, which if you just look now, do a search on stem cell treatment for Parkinson's, you'll see that it's a lot of recent things. Some of it's by patented cell lines, which I think is a horrible idea, but the government has allowed it, and so now that creates all the problems that patents cause. A lot of competition between groups and so forth. But they are getting stem cells to work, but it's not an easy thing. There's many issues getting those cells to do what you want. And but I want to say a little bit about the normal stem cells we have creating new neurons in the hippocampal formation, not just in the olfactory bulbs. So we'll say a little bit about that because we've talked about hippocampus before. And then the main topic for next time will be neocortex. Okay? The first chapter on neocortex, chapter 32. and I posted questions on that chapter. I've written questions for the next one, too. I'll get those posted probably later today.